This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa. JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 112 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. March Madness is not about the NCAA tournament, you guys. It's about NFL free agency. So many things happened this week, and so many of those things are going to affect fantasy football in 2018. So instead of the typical mailbag episode, I thought it'd be far more useful to go through the impactful free agency signings that we've seen over this week. And actually, I really didn't decide to change things up. You guys did. I went to Twitter and posted a poll to see what you guys wanted to hear, and a free agency episode won unanimously. I'm here for you. I'm here for you to be a degenerate. Before we look at some of the crazy moves from this week, though, remember that this March, FanDuel is joining in on the tournament fun with a free game called Bracket Pick'em. Instead of filling out a bracket, all you have to do is pick five teams, and there are over $25,000 in prizes to win. Visit FanDuel.com/bracket to play for free. That's FanDuel.com/bracket. And if you want to go to the tournament in person, just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code LATE to get $20 off. That's promo code LATE for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. So let's start things off by looking at the Browns. I know a lot of the moves that they made were trades, but they still happened over the last week, and they're going to have big fantasy football implications. Just to recap, the Browns now have Tyrod Taylor, Jarvis Landry, and Carlos Hyde to go along with Corey Coleman, Josh Gordon, David Njoku, and Duke Johnson. My first instinct when the Jarvis Landry trade went down was that there were going to be too many mouths to feed in that offense for elite production to come out of it this year. And I still kind of think that's the case. You've got Jarvis Landry, who before last season was a very volume-dependent fantasy football asset. I say before last year because he scored 9 times in 2017, easily a career high for Jarvis Landry. He combined to score 13 touchdowns over his previous 3 seasons, and he averaged a touchdown for every 31.46 targets over that time. Last year, he averaged a touchdown on every 17.89 targets. Over his last 3 years in Miami, Landry's seen at least roughly 27% of the team's targets. There's no chance in hell that that happens in Cleveland with 2 viable wide receivers and one of the league's best pass-catching backs in that backfield. Not only that, but Landry's Miami offense last year was actually the 4th most pass-heavy in the NFL, so his near 27% share was on a lot of passes. It remains to be seen how Jarvis Landry will be valued, and that goes for a lot of these guys that I'm going to talk about today, but this is not an ideal landing spot for Jarvis Landry. I think it's fine from a real football perspective because Jarvis Landry is very good at what he does, but from a fantasy standpoint, I'm nervous about him and his volume and his touchdown upside in this offense. And since we're talking about the passing attack, we might as well talk about Tyrod Taylor too. You guys probably know that I think that Tyrod Taylor is a pretty good quarterback. You could probably take me and put me in a bucket with all the other Tyrod Taylor truthers out there. I think that he's undervalued by most in the football world. According to NumberFire's net expected points metric, Tyrod was an average quarterback this year through the air on a per dropback basis when compared to the rest of the league, and that was the case last year as well. He was more efficient last year, but quarterback play dropped in 2017, so he was still average. I think we can give Tyrod Taylor somewhat of a pass because of who he was throwing to. Like, let's just at least say that Tyrod Taylor's a serviceable bridge quarterback for the Browns, because that's what I think that he is. I don't think he's elite, I'm not going to go crazy over Tyrod Taylor, but he's at least serviceable. I also don't even think that that's what's important for fantasy football here. We know he's not super elite, but we know he's not a dumpster fire of a quarterback either. Great. What I think is vital for fantasy purposes is that we know Tyrod Taylor is going to scramble. We know he's going to run. And when that happens, that limits the volume of the pass catchers in that offense. Now, don't get me wrong, DeShon Kizer did the same thing last year with the Browns. In fact, according to Pro Football Focus, Kizer had 47 scrambles versus Tyrod's 41 last year. But with Josh Gordon not playing the majority of the season, and with Corey Coleman hurt, and with Jarvis Landry not there, targets could still be funneled to certain players in the Browns' offense in 2017. Duke Johnson, for instance, saw 16.2% of the team's targets. That's the 12th highest target share that we've seen since 2011 at the running back position. But he also had the 16th most targets that we've seen since that time because the Browns, despite being in negative game scripts all the time, ranked 9th in pass attempts this past year. Given they didn't win a freaking game, you'd expect that to be higher. but DeShone Kizer took some of that away because he scrambles. Tyrod has essentially had 50 or so scrambles a season since becoming a starter in the league. Maybe that falls a bit because he's got a good supporting cast now, but it's just another reason as to why volume may not be there to support all of these weapons from a fantasy football perspective. And lastly, there's Carlos Hyde. Hyde's always been a pretty decent back, but I'm nervous about, and you guessed it, his receiving potential in Cleveland. He saw 14.5% of San Francisco's targets last year, which really helped him finish as a top 20 PPR back. But with Duke Johnson inevitably being the passing down back for the Browns, you're looking at Hyde being a fairly touchdown-dependent asset in fantasy football. And again, if there's competition for volume, whether on the ground or through the air, then there's competition for touchdowns too. I guess what I'm saying here is that things could be very spread out throughout the Cleveland offense if everyone stays healthy. Tyrod Taylor is going to be a very fun streaming option, but I'd be nervous investing any sort of early round pick in any of the other pieces in this offense. I doubt that you'll have to, but it's important to keep the volume aspect things in mind. It's the most important thing in fantasy football. And speaking of volume, I think that the consensus feeling towards Kirk Cousins going to Minnesota is that his pass attempt numbers should inevitably dip on a better team, leading to fewer fantasy points. People are nervous because of this volume issue with Kirk Cousins. Now, I don't think that the assumption that his pass attempts will fall is wrong per se, but keep in mind that the Vikings only threw 13 fewer passes than Washington did last year. They had a much lower pass to run ratio, sitting at 1.05 versus 1.35, but Washington didn't run nearly as many plays because the offense and defense both weren't as efficient as Minnesota's. Cousins has already proven to be a capable fringe top 5 passer in fantasy football. We've seen him consistently finish in the top 10 with Washington. And to me, it's really not about volume, because volume doesn't correlate as strongly to success at quarterback week to week as it does with other positions in fantasy football. It's about touchdowns. Touchdowns drive the game, and they drive the game for quarterbacks. Cousins has thrown 25 or more touchdown passes in each of the last three seasons. Of the 82 quarterbacks with 25 or more touchdowns over the last seven seasons, 32% finished outside the top 10 in season-long fantasy football scoring, and less than 10% of them finished outside the top 15. If you throw for 25 touchdown passes, you're going to be relevant in fantasy football in some way. Now, touchdown rates, or touchdowns divided by attempts, can fluctuate and regress year to year. When we see MVP seasons from quarterbacks, it's usually because they posted an unsustainable touchdown rate. Look at Cam Newton a few years ago. Look at Matt Ryan a couple seasons ago. Even Peyton Manning, when he's had his record-breaking seasons, had an unsustainable touchdown rate. Even for him. The normal touchdown rate across the NFL is about 4.5%. Cousins has topped that in two of his last three seasons. And good quarterbacks usually do. But not to the point of it being an outlier year over year. What this means is that, to me, the biggest difference for Cousins heading into 2018 with the Vikings, or I should say, the way that he becomes a true difference maker at the quarterback position in fantasy football, is through that touchdown rate statistic. He has far better weapons, but we have to also remember that he actually should have a running game now. He will have a reliable runner in the red zone in Dalvin Cook. So can he reach, say, a top five season? Of course Kirk Cousins can be a top five quarterback. Cousins has already shown that he can do that. But part of me thinks that he'll end up being overdrafted, because in order for him to have a true standout season in fantasy football, he'll need to basically have somewhat of an outlier season in touchdown rate. He'll need to reach about 35 touchdowns. And that's possible, but it's not worth a gamble given the position in fantasy football is so replaceable. And one last thing, you guys, I think a lot of times when we see a move like this, we assume everything will just get infinitely better for the weapons in that offense. But Case Keenum was good last year. Stephon Diggs and Adam Thielen were good last year too. Case Keenum probably wouldn't sustain that level of play, which is why the Vikings made this move, but he was still strongly supporting those two pass catchers in 2017. This move to get Kirk Cousins is more about that aspect of sustainability than it is this offense seeing some massive leap year over year. And my fear is that fantasy owners overpay for Thielen and Diggs when they actually had decent quarterback play statistically last year. It's just that you can now feel a little bit more secure with that quarterback play here in 2018. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time on the other quarterback signings, which basically consist of the Minnesota Vikings depth chart from last year. I think pass catchers from the Broncos, Jets, and Cardinals should get a slight bump with Keenum, McCown, Bridgewater, and Bradford at those locations. And I actually think that Sam Bradford and his move to Arizona is a pretty good one for Larry Fitzgerald, too. Not only did Arizona lose John Brown, but in Bradford's last three seasons with 200 or more attempts, he's averaged roughly 46% of his yards coming via the air. The league average over the last half decade is above 53%. He's had a 6.8, 7.1, and 6.4 average depth of target over that time. You know how we always make fun of Alex Smith's conservative nature? Well, Alex Smith's ADOT over his last three seasons have been 7.7, 6.8, and 6.8. Bradford's been even more conservative in terms of down the field throwing, and that should help Larry Fitzgerald rack up a ton of receptions. I'm going to jump to the tight end position real quick, where Trey Burton signed with the Bears and Jimmy Graham signed with the Packers. I mentioned this on a previous episode, but Trey Burton was actually one of my favorite free agents this year. He's an athlete who's played basically every skill position on offense from college through now. And he landed in a spot with basically an empty slate volume-wise. Yes, the Bears got Allen Robinson, and I'll talk about that in a second, but basically every pass catcher on that team from last year won't be seeing any sort of significant workload this season aside from those running backs. I think this is a good spot for Burton to land because he can grow into a pass-catching role all while seeing immediate volume. And it will hurt tight end Adam Shaheen long-term as well. But I'll get into the Bears a little bit more when I talk about Allen Robinson. But Jimmy Graham is going to Green Bay, and honestly, it makes me kind of angry. I feel like the Packers have been chasing the JerMichael Finley void for years, and while I think that Graham can be effective in certain areas of the field, aka the red zone, it's hard to get excited about everything outside of his touchdown potential. Last year, Jimmy Graham averaged 5.54 air yards per completed pass, 5.54 air yards per reception. His previous career low was 6.98. He just wasn't getting down the field that much, and while that can do with the issues in Seattle, it's not a good sign. And that's especially true when you consider his yards after the catch per catch was also one of the lowest of his career. That's not what you want to see when you've got a lower average depth of target. Now granted, he saw 14 targets within the opponent's 5-yard line, so that will skew things a bit. But he also only caught 20% of his deep ball targets, which was by far a career low for him. Basically, Jimmy Graham wasn't very good outside of scoring touchdowns close to the goal line last year. But that's also what pisses me off about this deal. Graham is now going to poach some scores from the other playmakers in the Green Bay offense. I know that Jordy Nelson is now gone, but we'd have a lot of scoring potential from the other pass catchers like Devontae Adams and Randall Cobb had they not gotten Jimmy Graham. Though I do think that Devontae Adams would just get his regardless. We'll see what they do with their wide receiver depth though. It feels like the Packers need to make a move there. Now, I already talked about Carlos Hyde, but there were other running back signings as well. Before we get into the big ones, I guess I should just mention Jonathan Stewart and Isaiah Crowell. Stewart is now reunited with general manager Dave Gettleman, and Gettleman said that Jay Stu is, quote, a quality runner with power and speed, and that he brings a veteran professional presence to our locker room. It feels like a veteran signing. I don't really see the need to be interested in a soon-to-be 31-year-old running back in an offense with overall poor offensive line play. And there's still a chance that the Giants take Saquon Barkley early in the draft based on Gettleman's love for the position, which I highlighted a couple of weeks ago in a mailbag episode. I don't think Stewart's going to be any sort of workhorse for the Giants this year. And then there's Isaiah Crowell. According to NumberFire's success rate metric, which measures the percentage of positive expected point runs a player makes, Crowell's been above average in just one of four seasons. That was also the one year where he saw the most significant difference in yards per carry versus his running back teammates' yards per carry, outproducing them by 0.28 yards per attempt. But again, this is kind of a whatever move given that the Jets, who signed Crowell, have pass catcher Bilal Powell in that backfield too, and Elijah McGuire is there as well. And New York is obviously not all that attractive for producing points, and that showed last year with just 5 instances where a running back in that offense finished as a top 12 RB1 in PPR formats. And no Jets running back did it more than twice. So I'm not that excited about either of those signings. One signing that I am incredibly excited about, though, is the 49ers getting Jerick McKinnon. That's one of the most open backfields in football from a volume standpoint, and the 49ers made McKinnon one of the highest paid running backs in the league. Jerick's been used in sort of a complimentary role so far in his career, but he's not getting second fiddle money. He's getting starter money. I've talked about this for what seems like forever, but we're in an NFL where running between the tackles doesn't matter nearly as much as being an able pass catcher. And McKinnon can absolutely do that. He's handled over 120 targets over the last two seasons, and he has 84 receptions. A lot of people may look at his efficiency and knock the dude, and I understand that to a degree. He averaged only 3.4 yards per carry in 2016 and 3.8 this past year, and his 2016 success rate was a very low 31.45%. That jumped to about 39% in 2017, which is about average. But last season was actually the first time where Jerick McKinnon didn't outperform his teammates' yards per carry average. And much of that had to do with Dalvin Cook, who's clearly a pretty good running back and a good running back prospect. Now, I think that the argument would then be, okay, then if you're going to give him top money, he should play like a top running back. He should be as good as Dalvin Cook. And I don't think that's wrong. I'm not here to just dissect the contract. I'm here to give you fantasy football advice and explain why I think that Jerick McKinnon is a pretty good running back. The numbers do suggest that he's thrived given his situation. That's what's key. Dalvin Cook's small sample looked better than McKinnon, but McKinnon has been a better in-between-the-tackles runner than any non-Cook running back in Minnesota over the last 2 years. And on top of that, he's a good pass catcher, which is just as important of a part to a running back's skill set as running the ball well. You can find running backs literally everywhere who can run well in between the tackles. It's more valuable to have ones who can do that well enough, all while catching passes out of the backfield. I think the 49ers still get a running back in the draft, but given that contract number, McKinnon should be involved in this up-and-coming 49ers offense. And that's big for his fantasy football potential. Now, the running back signing that's made the biggest fantasy football impact is Deion Lewis going to Tennessee. And it's because it's impacting two guys, with Derrick Henry moving from surefire RB1 territory to what the hell is happening to this backfield territory. I've seen takes on both sides from analysts. Some believe that Deion Lewis is the back to own in the backfield, others still believe that it's Derrick Henry, and Lewis is just coming in to be a complimentary back. I know Mike Mularkey is out of Tennessee, but I don't see why the two backs can't or won't be used like we saw with Derrick Henry and DeMarco Murray a season ago. In 2017, Murray handled about 42% of the team's rushes across 15 games, while Henry's share was roughly 40%. Henry far outperformed DeMarco Murray on the ground by just about any metric imaginable, though. In fact, Derrick Henry was one of the top running backs who outperformed his teammates most in 27, according to NumberFire's metrics. It was a crime that they weren't using Derrick Henry more. Deion Lewis is a better runner than DeMarco Murray is right now. There's no doubt about that. And while I think durability issues at the running back position are sometimes overrated, teams don't think that way. Teams may view someone like Deion Lewis as a more fragile back who can really work when he has the ball in his hands, but they may want to limit that overall workload. I don't want to say to the level of Chris Thompson because he's a much different runner, but expecting 250 carries from Lewis does not seem reasonable. But I do think that Deion Lewis will absolutely be the primary pass catcher in that offense. As Rich Rebar from RotoWorld.com noted, Derrick Henry was on the field for only 31.9% of Tennessee's passing plays last year. That's why he saw only 17 targets. And unfortunately, I think that we're going to see more of that with Henry getting more goal line looks. Murray and Henry each saw 7 touches from within the opponent's 5-yard line last year, and I would expect a shift towards Henry versus Lewis, giving him the touchdown upside. But this definitely hurts if you're a Derrick Henry truther, because the 3-down work won't be there this year. Despite the contract being pretty strong in Lewis's favor, I think that Henry will see more attempts in the backfield, but Lewis is going to get the work through the air, which is more important because targets are twice as valuable as attempts in half PPR formats. So to me, gone are the days where Derrick Henry is an RB1. Not only do the Titans have positive regression coming in the passing touchdown column that will hurt Henry, but they may not even be as run heavy as we've seen them under Mike Mularkey as well. If I have to choose one for fantasy football purposes next year, I'm going to go with the cheaper of the two options more than likely. Everything will depend on their average draft position. The first really big free agent move happened in Chicago with the Bears snagging Allen Robinson. They also got Taylor Gabriel, but we'll focus on A-Rob here because he's clearly the most important piece. I understand the concerns with Allen Robinson. He's coming off an ACL injury, and he was really inefficient in 2016. But we also know that he went ham in 2015 and is just one of 3 wideouts with 1,400 yards and 10 touchdowns in the season before turning 23. And the other 2 wideouts are Larry Fitzgerald and Randy Moss on that list, if you're curious. We don't know if Allen Robinson has an elite floor, but he definitely has an elite ceiling. I think that's sort of the best way to describe him at this point in his career. And he's still just 24 years old, you guys. He's less than 1.5 years older than Calvin Ridley. I love the fit in Chicago because, like I said with Trey Burton earlier, there's nothing there. There's no competition for targets. The Bears' wide receiving group was so bad last year that you could literally just wipe them off the team and no one would blink. Everything is up for grabs. And at this moment, in my eyes, A-Rob has a floor of about 120 to 130 targets. You've got a new offensive-minded head coach with a young quarterback, a good enough offensive line, and the Bears' defense is actually really underrated too. It was actually a top 10 unit according to NumberFire's schedule-adjusted metrics last year. The Bears are very obviously building like the Rams did. A new regime is inheriting an early first-round quarterback. The team has a running game in place, so the Rams had to invest in the offensive line to get there. The defense isn't bad. And then what are they doing on top of this? They're adding weapons for that quarterback. Jared Goff got Bobby Woods, Cooper Kupp, and Sammy Watkins, and now Mitch Trubisky is getting Allen Robinson, Trey Burton, Taylor Gabriel, and probably a wide receiver in the draft. And obviously, they already have Cam Meredith coming off of an injury. I'm not saying the Bears will make this miraculous turnaround like the Rams did this past year. They're in a tougher division, too. But I do think that the Bears are a lot better than most think. The key with everything Chicago Bears related is Mitch Trubisky. To be honest, I think that Robinson can still be a very viable fantasy option if he's healthy just on volume alone. But he can jump to the next tier if Trubisky also makes the leap. And Trubisky was not great last year. But as I learned after 2016, it's very tough to judge quarterbacks without weapons after their rookie seasons. Jared Goff ended up seeing the biggest adjusted net yards per attempt jump from one season to the next in NFL history last year. To assume Trubisky's going to do that would be foolish, but there's a good chance that he sees a pretty significant leap if the talent is there. And to be clear, Trubisky had better efficiency this past year than Goff saw with Jeff Fisher. So there's plenty of hope there. Overall, though, there weren't a ton of places where a wide receiver could go and walk into 130 targets. But I think Allen Robinson did that, and I see this as an upgrade over Jacksonville, where there wouldn't be as good of an opportunity. Now, speaking of the Jags, they re-signed Marquise Lee, and they added Dante Moncrief to a wide receiving group that already had Dede Westbrook and Keelan Cole. And this is on a team that had the second lowest pass-to-rush ratio in the NFL last year. The only reason there was any passing volume in Jacksonville was because they ran so many plays, so they finished 22nd in pass attempts in 2017. I'm trying to read the front office with the Jacksonville wide receivers. I don't know why they didn't franchise tag Allen Robinson. Maybe there was some controversy over a longer term deal. Maybe his medicals aren't as clean as we might think. I don't know. But at one point, there were reports of the Jags signing A-Rob over Marquise Lee, which means maybe they're not totally in love with Marquise Lee. I still think that Dede Westbrook is the most compelling wideout in this group. He had amazing production during his senior season at Oklahoma, and you guys know that I love me some college production at the wide receiver position, and he looked the part when he was healthy enough to see NFL action last year. Moncrief is an interesting piece only because, like a lot of these free agents, we don't really know how good he is. He's got the physical tools, and he scored a touchdown on every 104 receiving yards over his career, which is far above the league's average, but he's benefited from Andrew Luck. And there's an obvious scenario here where he doesn't come close to seeing enough volume. And that's really the biggest issue with Jacksonville. If they do what they want to do, the Jaguars are going to throw the ball no more than 530 times next year. In order for one of these guys to see 100 targets out of that, they'll need a near 19% target share. With four receivers competing for looks, that's no easy task. The Dolphins got what most consider redundant assets in Albert Wilson and Danny Amendola. When I saw them snag Albert Wilson, I thought that it was fine because I think that Wilson's better than most give him credit for. If you look at his catch rate at different depths chart on airyards.com, you can see that he exceeds the league's average all over the field in catch rate. And he has legitimately one of the best college production profiles that you're going to find. It was the Amendola signing where I scratched my head and then laughed because it's the Dolphins. I don't know what this does for the Miami Dolphins. They have so many holes on that roster, they're not going to compete this year, and they go and get a 32-year-old wide receiver. I fear that DeVante Parker's ADP is still going to be too high because of his name, so Kenny Stills may be the only receiver I remotely care about on that team this year. But I really do think that Miami could be a dumpster fire. Paul Richardson is going to Washington in what looks like another tough-to-project situation. P. Rich was a very good prospect, or is a good prospect, I guess you could say, but he was used in a deep ball role in Seattle. In 2017, over 36% of his targets traveled 15 or more yards through the air, which ranked 11th highest of the 85 wide receivers with 50 or more targets last season. Josh Doctson, who's already in Washington, ranked 23rd on that list. I think it's easy to just use the role that a player had on one team and project it on another, but you also have to hope that these coaching staffs know what they're doing. Alex Smith has had one outlier season where he's thrown the deep ball well. I can't really see a scenario where he's able to do what he did last year again. He completed over 18% of his deep balls when his previous high with the Chiefs was 15%, and he threw 13 touchdowns on balls that went 15 or more yards through the air. His previous high was 5. It sounds like, though, that they want Richardson to be more of the field stretcher in this offense given his speed, which means good things for Josh Doctson. But I truthfully think that there's a chance that Paul Richardson is just a better wide receiver than Josh Doctson is. Volume-wise, the best bet is on Doctson. But like a lot of these situations, I think we'll see a pretty annoying distribution in the Washington offense this year. I'm going to skip over the Ravens because I think that they have arguably the worst skill position group in the NFL right now, and things are changing a lot within that group. But don't sleep on Chris Moore. That's my take with the Baltimore Ravens. Instead of ending today's show with the Ravens, I thought that we could close things out with one of the more controversial topics in fantasy football right now, and that's the value of Sammy Watkins. I wrote an article on NumberFire this week after it was reported that Sammy was signing with the Chiefs. And I have to be honest with you guys, when things first went down, my immediate thought was, Sammy's a great fit for Pat Mahomes, but he's not going to see enough volume to be relevant in this offense in fantasy football. But then I dug in and analyzed things and realized that this is not so bad. Now, I don't think we truly know how good or bad Sammy Watkins actually is. He had a great 2015 season, but that season was also kind of an outlier. As I said in my article, since 2011, we've had 322 wide receiver seasons where the pass catcher saw 90 or more targets. Watkins 2015 ranked 7th in percentage of yards coming from throws that traveled 15 or more air yards. And of the players in front of him on that list, none have had a repeat performance. It's very hard to do what Sammy Watkins did in 2015 more than once. He was basically just a deep ball monster that year. And look, he can play that role as his floor in Kansas City, I think. But I also think that there's a chance that three players from one team end up seeing triple-digit targets this season. It really does not happen often at all, but I think that it's possible for Kansas City because they're rebuilding on the defensive side of the ball, there could be shootouts as a result of that, and there's really a concentration of targets that will go to Tyreek Hill, Travis Kelce, Sammy Watkins, and then the running backs. Albert Wilson was actually pacing towards a 14% target share last year, and if the Chiefs end up throwing just slightly more than they did last year, which I think is entirely possible, then Watkins will only need to increase the target share that Wilson was seeing by about 4%. Given the talent and the money spent on Sammy Watkins, I think that's very reasonable. And I think there's a good chance that Watkins is easily the best fantasy football value in the Chiefs offense this year, Pat Mahomes aside. He'll be a cheaper way to get involved in that offense. If you're nervous about Tyreek Hill's potential regression and maybe the fact that he could see a slight dip in target share, maybe Sammy's the dude that you want to target. Now, I'm always a little bit nervous about getting wide receivers who are joining new teams, but this is a value play above all else. And like the other players mentioned on today's show, we'll have to wait for their cost to see how we really feel about each player. This is a game of value. It's a game of reading the market. But I do like Sammy Watkins' fit in the Kansas City offense. That's going to be it for today's show. Thanks to everyone for listening. I really do appreciate it. If you've yet to subscribe to the Late Round Podcast, do so by going to Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher. And don't forget to check out NumberFire.com before the NCAA tournament starts to get some awesome analytical advice about this year's big dance. Otherwise, everyone, enjoy your weekend, and I will be in your ears again early next week.